This is the last Sunday in August, the last day in August, and the end of the church year, not by law or calendar, but simply by our perception of things. The church year begins again on the Sunday after Labor Day, so we are at the tail end of it. This is normally a bad day for churches because everybody has taken off for the lakes or the mountains for one last fling before the kids are locked into school for the next 9 months. So we are especially grateful to have you present this morning. Some of you may be having visits from your families, as Billy and I are, with our daughter Karen and son-in-law Jim and their three children, April, Cress, and Tanner, up for a visit from Tulsa, where they moved recently after living a stone's throw from us for 12 years. It's good to hear the laughter of children in our house. I promised last week to respond this morning to a couple of questions out of the many questions that pile up over the course of several weeks. Not all those questions make suitable topics for the pulpit. For example, a woman asked me the other day about the Jesuits, a topic most of you would not be excited about, but it was fun to tell her what I knew about the Jesuits, and even more fun for me to go back to the source books and check on how well I had remembered what I once knew. I had remembered that they are the teaching order of the Catholic Church, remarkably insistent upon discipline and academic excellence, and some other things, but I had forgotten some of the major American colleges which are Jesuit schools. Creighton, in neighboring Nebraska, Georgetown, Marquette, Loyola of Chicago. I don't know what to do with that information. I can't make use of it in the pulpit, and although I did fantasize such a thing, it's highly unlikely that I'll ever be on a game show where the announcer says, "You've won the chance, Mr. Myers, to try for the big jackpot prize of $50,000. Are you ready? Can you name three colleges in the U.S. which are run by the Jesuit order? If it ever comes, I'll win." But some of the questions are of wider interest. Questions I know have occurred to some of you who have never asked them. I've picked a couple of those, and here's the first one. From an extremely devout young woman, not of this church, who sat with us at a table outside one day for a kind of picnic meal and inquired in a rather solemn voice if we were going to say grace. When I said, "No, we don't always say grace," she widened her eyes and said, "But you're Christians," as if it were beyond all dispute that a Christian would say grace at every meal, three times a day, out loud, and do it outside or even at Wendy's if one of the meals happened there. And then an even more serious thought occurred to her. "And besides, you're a minister," with the unspoken assumption that if one is a minister, one is expected to be more pious and punctilious than anybody else. I suppose there may be ministers who are better than everybody else in their church, though I have never met one. I have a grave suspicion that some of us who minister have heard that expectation expressed so many times that we've been tempted to believe we are better than others, even when it is painfully clear to all our friends that we are not. But back to table blessings. Should one feel guilty if one does not say grace aloud at every meal? Not is it often good when one says it, but is it an essential discipline of the Christian life to say words aloud before each and every meal? Some Christians don't do this. Do they have any valid reasons? I would think that any honest person would admit that praying over food can sometimes become perfunctory. The ritual becomes rote. The food gets cold when Uncle Ben decides to unload his whole storehouse of thank yous to God. The prayers get stale and predictable until no one really listens. It is true that the Apostle Paul said, "Give thanks for everything," which is our support for saying grace. And that general advice must surely include our daily bread, but we have never understood him to mean that we have to speak our gratitude out loud each morning that the tires are still inflated, that the street is paved, that the smog has lifted, and that we still have our jobs. I doubt we could manage that kind of mechanical gratitude and keep it fresh and genuine. Now, I think it's quite possible that I have lost something by not insisting on grace before every meal, but perhaps our family gained something by not having gratitude for food become predictable. It was almost totally predictable in my family as I was growing up. Dad would say the prayer rapidly when he was famished, mechanically when he was tired, always the same words, the same inflections, and though I loved him, I often felt those ritual prayers were not very fresh or significant. I didn't want that to happen in my own family, so we didn't say table grace automatically 3 times a day. I'm sure we missed some of the benefit of daily habit. I'm equally sure we gained something. We managed to avoid what I think of as cheap grace, the kind that comes sometimes from unvarying custom and rote prayers and turns into lifeless platitudes by being said too many times in exactly the same way. I confess to some sympathy for that hungry boy, young enough to be utterly candid, a boy impatient and perhaps wise beyond his years, who wondered out loud one day why all the food, when it is first hauled in from the grocery, could not be blessed at once. "Do the eggs need to be blessed singly?" he asked his mother. "And the round steak they would have that night?" Well, we live out our Christian profession in lots of ways, so your answer to this question may not be the same as mine. I happen to think that every single day ought to be a day of thanksgiving, but I'm not convinced that one has to speak out loud an official proclamation. We have to be tolerant of different feelings. Not every person who mechanically says grace before meals turns out to be a genuinely thankful person, despite the routine of his prayers. I have discovered that. While some people who are not rigid about ritual prove by their whole lives that they are constantly grateful, I would refuse to pass judgment on the convictions of either one. Second question. "You didn't wear your robe one day," he said. "Why not? Were you too hot? And by the way, why do some ministers wear robes and others do not? Where did the idea of wearing clerical dress come from in church history?" Those questions came after I left my robe off one day this summer, for the first time since I've been with you, because the guest speaker that day, a dear friend of mine, does not wear a robe when he preaches, and I wanted to make him feel comfortable. But the history of vestments is a little more complicated than that. In the early centuries of the church, there was no official dress for ministers. They wore the ordinary dress of the time, which was usually a toga, that loose wrap-around outer garment you've all seen in pictures. This was slowly replaced by a linen robe with close sleeves over which was worn a tunica, a slip-on garment often belted and with or without sleeves. On ceremonial occasions, people might wear a casula, a circular piece of cloth with a hole in the center so it could pass easily over the head. That was common dress. After the Roman Empire fell, around 476, most people adopted a new kind of dress, but the clergy, almost always conservative, hung on to the older form, perhaps tied to it emotionally. So they became easily identifiable, set apart from the rest of the worshiping congregation, simply because they wore the old familiar habit. So simply as that did clerical vestments develop. As for the stole, which drapes around the shoulders, it was once a scarf of office worn by high officials. It got adopted after a while by the clergy. I think by then they were becoming ambitious. And then creativity and imagination and sometimes the spirit of competition went wild. I really don't know how to draw the line between what is modest and what is ostentatious. I've looked at one person in a robe and thought, that's okay. And I've looked at another with elaborate stole and a hood trimmed with ermine, and I've thought, that's too much. I happen to be well equipped with stoles, five of them in all, one for each season of the church year and one for funerals, because a lovely lady by the name of Eleanor Long from another church bought them for me as a gift, hand-stitched in Philadelphia and more expensive than I could ever have justified. I think some ministers and priests have liked the idea that if they wear a special garment to show they are clergy, it might help them to resist temptation. In other words, if everyone sees I am a minister or a priest, expectation about how I should act will help me act that way. I think there's logic in that. I began to wear a robe in the pulpit only when I became a congregationalist in a large, beautiful church where robes were part of the tradition. But there are many congregational churches which do not like them and feel they are a betrayal of the classic congregational insistence upon simplicity and modesty. I once thought that I would never wear a robe, having grown up with ministers in dark suits and black shoes, but I must admit that when I began to do it, I really had a sense that this was a way of submerging my own personality and reminding me that all I was a kind of mouthpiece for the great ideas of the Bible. I think I began to take my solemn responsibility in the pulpit more seriously than ever, the robe becoming a symbol of what it was I was called to do. As you may have noticed, I have had a much harder time getting excited about the different colors which are prescribed for each season of the church year. This has seemed peripheral to me, although I realize that to people who have grown up in a different tradition, it can be a very important matter. If it is to you, I shall need forgiveness. I realized a long time ago that while I've grown away from low church worship service, with the children crying in the sanctuary and old-time gospel songs, I would never be comfortable in a high church setting. I once had a co-minister by the name of Eric Arndt, some of you remember Eric, who paused when he came up into the chancel and with his back to the audience made a little bow of reverence to the cross. I wanted very much to be cooperative, so I tried this a couple of times, but I quickly found that I could not do it with a sense of integrity. It struck me as a kind of idolatry, this bowing to an object made of brass, and although I knew Eric wasn't being ostentatious, that it came very natural to him, it seemed ostentatious to me, a kind of public display of piety, and simply not a thing I found comfortable. My colleague, to do him justice, was considerate of the weaker brother in this case and quit doing it himself. Issues like this are the sideshows on the midway, not the main event. So before we say goodbye to August, let me remind you very quickly what is the main event, and I'll do it with a brief story, true story. Not long ago, up in Nebraska, a funeral was held for a physician, a man so popular they had to hold it in the high school to make room for everybody. The local newspaper editor spoke at the funeral, and he made Dr. Westbrook sound like a real person. He said the doctor drove too fast. Everybody in town knew that he drove too fast. So much so, in fact, that the state finally limited his driving to the city limits. Defiantly, the doctor learned to fly and crashed his plane. One guesses that the doctor was not an easy man to be around sometimes. Doc was not a patient man, the editor admitted. When the county gravel trucks drove by his house too fast and put his children in danger, he hired a backhoe to dig a slowdown ditch across the street. He had to fill it in, but by that time he'd made his point. And then the editor began to remember the other things, how the doctor had put a pacemaker in a 95-year-old woman who then lived to be 100, how he forgot bills some people could not pay, how he sent a 3-year-old child to heart surgeon Denton Cooley and then paid for the operation himself by delivering a Tennessee walking horse to Houston. I gather that the doctor was sometimes short-tempered and irascible and stubborn and ornery, but he was also unselfish and compassionate in his own unpretentious way, the kind of man the church hopes to create out of what comes into it. They sang Amazing Grace at his funeral, and it was appropriate. How strange and surprising it was that out of this flawed human being there should have come so much goodness and love. It seems to me that's about the only hope we have. That once in a while, helped by knowing one another and by being here on Sundays, lifted up by the songs we hear and the verses read to us by our children, we stumble once in a while, by the grace of God, into something decent. I hope very much that this church will from time to time cause that to happen to every one of us. In the name of Christ our Lord, amen.